Stephen A. Young is an author, musician, and natural philosopher known by the music alias Headflux and also for his book, A Fool's Wisdom, Science Conspiracies and the Secret Art of Alchemy. Based in Scotland, a husband and father of three, he holds a Master of Science and PhD in theoretical physics, and since departing academia in 2005, created a solo career as an independent music producer, creating over 100 records, including remixes and library works, and performing at clubs and festivals internationally. From the years 2015 through 2018, Steve spent some time soul-seeking in Central America and Hawaii, participating in shamanic ceremonies, learning alchemy, and the traditional ways of healing with plant medicines and music. The first fruits of this new knowledge was audio alchemy, a practical method of music production based in hermetic teachings and a complete set of correspondences between music and alchemy. This was taught to students in a series of retreats in Hawaii and some smaller workshops throughout the U.S. and Europe. And on April 1st, 2024, after more than 2 years in development, he released his first book, A Fool's Wisdom, which challenges contemporary scientific dogmas in light of the alchemical perspective. And his book was a number one bestseller in Western philosophy on Amazon US. And for this episode, this is what we cover, his new book, A Fool's Wisdom. And I gotta commend Steve for his bravery because he is, to my knowledge, the first theoretical physicist to speak out against theoretical physics and several other dogmatic scientism fields of so-called study. And he strings them together in a pretty incredible way and shows how one sort of ties into the other, and much of society buys into this totally false paradigm that is propped up through these various scientific or scientism dogmas. And it is occulting alchemical knowledge, which leads one to the true nature of this realm, the true knowledge of this realm, the true nature of the self, and true knowledge of the self. And this book is awesome. It's incredible. I remember pulling my wife aside a couple of times as I began reading it, because as you know, I've put a lot of attention into the failed germ paradigm, and I have not yet taken a deep dive into some of these other fields that relate to that. And Steve does a good job showing how all of them relate to each other to create this false paradigm. And it's really an example of putting words to something that I've always known deep down. So I call that remembering rather than learning. So I guess you could say Steve is helping us to remember. And if you're interested in the book, please head to the link in the show notes to check it out. Highly recommend it. And if you're not sure yet, just listen to this episode, and I think you might want to get the book afterwards. So thanks for tuning in. Much love, you guys, and enjoy the episode. All right, Steve, thanks for joining me, man. I'm really looking forward to this. So we're discussing A Fool's Wisdom, Science Conspiracies, and the Secret Art of Alchemy. And I got to give you credit, man, because to speak about what you speak about in this book, you may be the first of your kind that I know of to go this deep. To speak about of the absurdity of what you've been indoctrinated with. So I got to give you credit for that first off. But yeah, let's just like jump into your background first and what led you to writing this book.
Sure. Well, thanks again for having me on, Alec. Yeah, it's you know, in writing a book, I think you have the freedom to like make your point a lot bigger and a lot more, you know, to do a lot more justice, you know, which is something I felt I could never really do on social media, just putting out, you know, thoughts here and there. So a few years ago, after all the pandemonium, I sort of became a bit of a hermit, but I couldn't keep my mouth shut. You know, I had to focus my my knowledge into something, and I'd wanted to write a book for some years, so it all just made sense. And, you know, I talked a lot about alchemy in the past, and ultimately I wanted to teach people about alchemy because it's like this ancient science that is out there, and I wanted to talk about it, but I found it was a difficult subject to talk about because people are literally indoctrinated with modern science, which is a set of theories that are opposed to every principle of alchemy. And, you know, it took me some years to realize this, but that like every sort of modern theory of the last few hundred years of science is directly opposed to one of the key principles of alchemy. And so I started to get the idea that actually, it seems like it's just propped up in order to hide alchemy. It's like they're actually hiding alchemy with this modern science. And so that was sort of the basis of the book. And so it's very much written in two parts. So the first part looks at all the criticisms of all the modern scientific theories. And then in the second part, it reveals the ancient signs of alchemy, and really with the aim of showing people that there is a natural science which is universal and common to all ancient cultures, and you know, it doesn't require actually any theories at all. It's completely tied up with practical science. You know, it's not a theoretical science. It's theory and practice together as one. So I wanted to reveal the alchemy, but also before I could do that, I had to you know, criticize and rebuke the modern science. So that's really the essence of the book, a book of two halves, as it were.
You were formally trained in modern, quote, science, too. So you talk about it in the book, but can you share what led you to discover alchemy in the first place and sort of cast aside all you were indoctrinated with?
Yeah, so, well, after coming out of university with a PhD in theoretical nuclear physics...
What is that? Even just, you know, saying theoretical nuclear physics, how does that sound coming out of your mouth at this point?
Well, I mean, you know, it's, you know, I went to university, you know, perfectly innocent, you know, looking to learn about the world.
Yeah.
And I got caught up in the excitement of this new physics, as they call it, you know, the new physics of the 20th century, which is things like quantum mechanics and relativity and so on. So I got caught up into that. And of course, there was lots of that at university as well. So it seemed like this was the future. This was, you know, so I threw myself into it and, you know, took it as far as I could, which is ultimately to PhD level, which I graduated at the age of 25. So, you know, 25, I'd been in education my whole entire life at this point. And then I come out expecting, you know, there's going to be all these opportunities, but, you know, actually finding meaningful work that actually used the knowledge that I'd gained at university was, you know, impossible. I mean, I was unemployed for 6 months, applying for jobs all over the place, all these weird places. But it seemed like I was either overqualified or underqualified, or, you know, just there was just no real use for the stuff I'd been learning.
What typical lines of work do people that are theoretical nuclear physicists end up in?
Well, I would say the most common one is banking, which I was determined not to get into because it's frightfully boring for me. But I ended up getting into IT consulting and ended up consulting for banks anyway. So, you know, I sort of ended up in banking anyway.
You tried to avoid banking, but still ended up working in banking somehow.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, the banking sector is the largest employer of PhD physicists, you know.
That is so interesting. I wonder why that is.
Yeah. So I had a job for 5 years, but the whole time I was just like dreaming of being an independent artist. You know, I'd been sort of a hobbyist in music and electronic music and DJ for a long time, and sensed an opportunity to like go professional with that, you know, making music on my computer at home in my studio. And in 2010, that's what I did. I quit my job. I'm like, right, let's go all in with music. I'm just going to work from home. I'm going to make music, do gigs, and just see where it takes me. And I did that, you know, 10 years solid. It was like international touring and, you know, made over 100 tunes. But you know, while I was doing that, I was also researching and reading and studying. But you know, in my public life, I was a musician entertainer. But you know, at home, I was still researching and reading and trying to get to the bottom of, you know, fundamental science. And yeah, so this led me down a path of shamanism. So shamanism was very alluring to me because, you know, the stories you hear, the healing, the miraculous healings that people have, the visions that people see and all this, this was very alluring and intriguing to me. And I kind of threw myself into that and took part in a number of medicine ceremonies in Central America and in the UK. And they were a real game changer. You know, it took me out of my sort of materialistic programming and showed me this inner world and this, you know, world, this mysterious spiritual world, of which I just couldn't explain at all with the science I'd been taught. You know, I couldn't just put in terms like what was actually happening in these shamanic experiences. And this ultimately led me to alchemy. You know, at the beginning of these ceremonies, they'll be talking about the fire and the earth and the air and the water and things like this, you know. So I got a sense that there was this natural science that these people practice. And, you know, I was kind of coming at it from this like super theoretical, like quantum point of view and trying to explain it with that. But
a lot of people still do that, by the way. And I tend to think that that's more of the new age sect of the freedom/consciousness, whatever this overlapping community is, those are the people that attribute it to some sort of quantum particle theoretical phenomena.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Because we have these theories installed in our brain and then we have an experience and then we feel we have to then interpret the experience through the theoretical models we've been given. But, you know, when you've been trying to do that for years or decades and the models never actually seem to work effectively at explaining anything, you know, you start to question it more and more. And so I guess I had a number of awakenings, you could call it, where I realized that, you know, a big part of my education was just wrong or false, you know, or just like a new idea which had been, you know, pushed into me, but which, you know, ancient peoples and, you know, people who live a natural life, you know, don't need these ideas, they can't use them. And I couldn't find any real place where they were being used, you know. You know, with theoretical physics, there's got to be like an application of it, you know, to make it real. It's like if there's no application, then it's not real. So with something like quantum physics, there's only a handful of applications they claim for quantum physics. And what I found is when I looked into those, they weren't actually applications of quantum physics. They were applications of engineering, and it was like the quantum physics theorists had like retroactively taken credit for the invention as if it was born out of the minds of quantum physicists, but actually it was born from the work of engineers and technicians, and it's just like the theorists have tried to explain it and then claim credit for it in retrospect, you know. And I found that with all of the alleged applications of quantum physics. you know, that was just with quantum physics. But in the book, I talk about five main theories that are the foundation of all modern theories. And it's, you know, atomism, gravity, heliocentrism, evolution, and the germ theory. And of course, I learned all about the germ theory through people like yourself and Dr. Tom Cowan and Andrew Kaufman. I knew nothing about germ theory prior to 2020. But in some ways, the like what happened there just kind of revealed the whole system of modern scientific thought, because like everyone, you know, even if they weren't biologists or germ theorists or doctors, like all they got on board with all that as well. It's like the whole system seemed to act as one mind. So it was very revealing. And so with the book, I thought I want to tie it all together. I want to, you know, I don't want to just write a book about physics or, you know, one specific area. I want to tie together all the modern science and the ancient alchemy, like all together in one book. And I think that's important because a lot of people are trapped in their own fields of specialty. You know, there's like a filter bubble type effect where someone can be like really knowledgeable within this like one area, but then still have no idea of, you know, the what else is going on outside of them. And so I knew I had nothing new to say about germ theory or nothing new to say even about flat earth or whatever. It's like loads of people have been saying this stuff for years, but I thought it was just worth tying it all together, all the criticisms against all the modern theories, and then showing that actually there's an ancient science that works perfectly well, so you don't actually need any of that stuff, you know. That was the aim anyway.
Did an incredible job. I'd like to follow the thread as you laid it out in the book, actually. One of the things that you mentioned towards the beginning is how there's a major difference between classical physics and quantum / theoretical physics, but they're sort of lumped into one category with this sort of golden calf worshiping allure that whole branch of quote science knows what it's talking about. They're the authority figures. They've figured out how reality works, when really, because they've lumped it in again, classical physics is watching objects in motion and then coming up with, you know, ways to explain cause and effect of watching objects in motion, basically observing something happening and then trying to figure out the cause of that naturally occurring phenomenon. But then you have quantum and theoretical physics, which are lumped in with that very cleverly. And I think you do a really good job at the beginning of the book, sort of delineating the difference between the two and showing how we've been tricked.
Yeah. So, I mean, they, you know, when I was at uni, they would talk about pure science, as in, you know, pure science would be science which has no application, and then applied science, which would be the one, you know, the type of science that leads to applications and products and so on. You know, and I thought, you know, there's nothing wrong with pure science. I mean, we need thinkers, right? We need people to think. But it's like, if there's all these people just thinking and it's not actually like translating to anything beneficial for, you know, real people or for the world, then, you know, I think we kind of have a problem there. You know, it's like you've got all these like people who they want to do good work. They have inquisitive minds. They're, you know, they're learned. It's like they want to work, but they're all being like kind of kettled together into this, you know, academic, it's like an insular, like limited hangout where they can all just talk about whatever it is they're theorizing about without any accountability for like, well, you know, have you actually made anything yet? You know, have you actually created any benefits for humanity? And so it turns out the real difference between theoretical work and practical work is that, you know, practical work, you can do it and produce a thing. But with theoretical work, you have to believe it. You know, like, I mean, you have to believe it because it's like permeates everything. It's in all of the, it's in physics, chemistry, and biology. It's in the media. It's, you know, assumed true. Like these theories are just assumed true by all reasonable people of society, right? And we're told that it was all agreed upon long ago by a consensus and, you know, they figured it out. But, you know, the more you look at these things and you, you know, criticize them, they just begin to crumble under scrutiny. And of course, you find the people who are pushing these ideas never really respond to criticism. You know, they just pretend it's not there, or they use ad hominem attacks and just smear people and block people and just carry on. And, you know, we see that now, like with the whole, you know, pandemic shenanigans, like all the evidence we've seen in the last 4 years, it still hasn't changed the course of academia or government or stuff. They just carry on the same regardless. You know, I just felt there's like something really wrong here, you know, and so I wanted to address that in the book.
Yeah, I think you did a really good job. And I think that when we're talking about observing a naturally occurring phenomenon and trying to figure out what is the cause of that phenomenon, that that sort of aspect of what we call science is the true science. And then, well, alchemy is the true science, and we'll get to that. But the, in terms of modernity, setting aside the truth about alchemy, that's like classical physics is modern science. Like that's, I mean, that is the proper science rather. And yeah. Theoretical and quantum physics leaves us up for just having to trust mathematical models, which is another thing as well, that math itself is just a language that can be used to explain things that have been observed and found to be true, but also be explained to, you know, be used to explain things that are completely untrue or have never been proven to be true. And that's where it's like, I think you use the quotes from Michio Kaku. I think that's how you pronounce his name, several of them. And then I know Tesla was quoted saying something similar, that modern quote science isn't doing science at all. They're calling what they're doing science, but it's actually just using mathematical modeling.
Yeah. So I would say with classical physics, isn't even necessarily about cause or causality. It's just about relationships between quantities, you know, and that's why it works so well. It's like, you know, the you know, if you put something in the bath, then the level changes in proportional to the volume, right? It's like, you know, things like that. It's you look at one like an independent variable and how it's affected by other changes that you make, and then you get a mathematical relationship between them, and then that lets you then understand and work with the system and, you know, make products and, you know, make designs from it. But it's not necessarily you know, answering the question of what causes things to be like this, you know. In the days before science, it would just be, well, it's God, right? God made it that way. You know, that's the cause, right? But of course, science is a godless creed, so it has to explain everything without invoking a creator or, you know, anything like that. And so in doing that, there seems to be this race to the bottom, right, where it's like you have to explain the smaller and smaller, you know, levels until they've basically gone down to a level where no one can access, you know, no one can see or measure.
And that's atomism.
That's the atomism. So it just goes, I mean, you know, we're talking like 10 to the minus 15 meters, you know, or like a million times smaller than a nanometer. And then they're saying that basically at that level of reality, there is this like untapped power source, which, you know, they can like unlock with special knowledge and special technology and all that. They can unlock this awesome power, and it has the potential to destroy worlds and everything. And yeah, so, you know, that is highly questionable, because the only proof of that so-called theory are nuclear bombs. But, you know, they're just regular bombs. You know, when you really get down to it, so there's no justification for putting the word nuclear in front of it, really. When you get down to it, it's like a you know, it just puffs it up, makes it seem like it's more special than just a regular explosive. But you know, I think you've talked about this before, but yeah, when you really start picking it apart and looking at it, there's no evidence that the bombs were actually nuclear. So then your applications of nuclear physics then just drop. Right. It's like the bomb was the only proof we had, you know.
Before we get into atomism, gravity, heliocentrism, evolution, and germ theory, I want to touch on one more thing, because this is something that I've been trying to articulate that you articulate so well in the book, the issues with quantum physics and referring to everything. You even see these trends in the sort of new age leaning health freedom space to call everything that we see quantum entanglement, quantum phenomena. We have quantum healing devices. Like, that word always bothered me, because it seems to be a godless way of trying to explain these mysterious aspects of reality that can be easily explained when you bring back in the context of ether.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So can you touch on, like, from your perspective, the issues with quantum? Because we see that word thrown around so much in this space, and I get what people are attempting to explain or trying to say when they use the word quantum, but it's always bothered me, and you explain it so well in the book, the problems with quantum.
Yeah. Well, it's like, well, once you accept quantum, is then everything is quantum, right? Because it's like we're made from atoms, and atoms are quantum. So everything's quantum. I'm quantum. You know, it's just like you can say anything is quantum once you accept that we're made from quantum particles. So, but what do you even mean when you say something is quantum? You know, in quantum physics, it refers to essentially the ability of a particle to, like, jump, you know, from one point in space to another without going through the space in between, like a quantum leap. And, you know, so, you know, that's essentially what they're saying, is that these particles are able to, like, you know, move in and out of reality and, like, make little, like, leaps and jumps, all, of course, while spinning and wobbling and orbiting around each other and, you know, phasing in and out of reality or whatever it is they claim that it does now. But, you know, ultimately the theory of atoms is directly opposed to the theory of ether, because ether says there is a fabric, you know, that there's a fabric in the space which is all connected, like water or like air, where, you know, everything is connected, everything is as one, and it's all happening inside of that.
Yeah.
But the atomism sort of flips that around and says, you know, everything's made from little hard balls, which are separate. They're all separate from each other. In fact, they can't touch each other. You know, that they're these little hard balls, and they're all separated in space. So it's a completely opposite worldview from one in which everything is connected to one in which everything is separate. Right. And this leads to materialistic, you know, ideologies, you know, materialism, and, you know, this led to gravity and all these other things.
I mean, the perfect example of that over the last 4 years is trying to explain what's going on by coming up with a theoretical, and it is, it's a totally theoretical particle that has never been proven to exist.
Yeah.
That's a virus. Yeah. That a virus is a theoretical particle that has never actually been demonstrated to exist. When you bring back in the context of ether and the human biofield and just the ability to be indoctrinated in mass, and us playing out that in mass through psychosomatics and things like this, which are, I would say, well-established phenomena, it all makes so much more sense than trying to explain it via this totally theoretical particle. And that's where I think atomism leads us wrong, is that it's trying to explain literally every facet of reality with some sort of theoretical particle. Another example, with respect to gravity, which can be explained with density, buoyancy, and just electromagnetism, is they're trying to say that, oh, well, we don't know the cause, but our mathematical models indicate that there's likely this particle called a graviton that is what's causing this phenomenon to happen. And it's all rooted in materialism, looking for particles, looking for the smallest units to explain something that can be more easily explained when you just cast all that nonsense aside and bring back in ether and the elements.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So quantum physics specifically sort of hides the ether, but also hides two other things: transmutation of metals and free energy. You know, so these are like three things when you go to physics class, you get told, you know, in no uncertain terms. It's like there's no such thing as ether, but you can't transmute metals, or you know, officially they say that it's possible with particle accelerators, but requiring so much energy and cost as to be not worth doing. And then of course they tell you there's no such thing as free energy as well, and you know, these things are, you know, not true. Energy is all around us, infinite, abundant, will never run out. But, you know, you're immediately put into this sort of scarcity, materialistic indoctrination through the physics education. And it extends into chemistry and into biology as well. And I mean, that's how, to be honest, that's how I found the virus theory so kind of easy to debunk. I mean, I read the Stefan Lanka paper in 2020. And it just it wasn't hard for me to think, well, this is theoretical, because like you say, a virus is a particle. It's actually a molecule made from atoms. And so I was just like, oh, here we go. But yeah, and then seeing, of course, you guys showing the, actually looking at it from, you know, I was looking at it from the quantum side, if you like, and then there's all these people looking at it from the top down through the microscopes, and, you know, like, where is the actual substance, you know, of virus? You know, there is no substance. And so, yeah, so that was, if you like, a virus is an application of quantum theory as well, because how could you postulate such a thing existing if you didn't also believe in atoms and molecules and all this other stuff as well? So yeah, it seemed like virus is almost like the cherry on top of this, like, you know, hundreds of years of new science. Yeah,
and we already touched on nuclear a little bit too, that's kind of where this leads, this materialistic approach, and then the big psyop, I would say, in atomism aside, and I know you go to the germ theory as well, but it ties into atomism. It really does, because it's, again, when it comes to the virus element of germ theory, that is a theoretical particle that you could then reattach to atomism. But then the other big thing, just aside from the general materialistic obsessed sentiments in the scientific community, would be nuclear bombs, which you've already discussed, which, I mean, that is so unbelievably absurd. I think there are enough people debunking that at this point. When you look at, there's no radiation fallout in several of these places that were alleged to have nuclear bombs blasted. You look at that, there's the video footage, the alleged video footage of nuclear bombs exploding. The cameras somehow totally survived. They find glitches in the cameras where there was a car in the frame and then no longer in the frame. I mean, I think it's all a scare tactic, just like the virus is, to keep us afraid of some perpetual thing that's never going to happen. And that's not to say they can't, when it comes to the germ theory or things like this, you know, create or even use frequencies or create chemicals that can have an effect of multiple people getting sick in the same space to create the appearance of germs passing, just like with nuclear bombs, they can just use real fucking bombs that cause massive explosions that cause damage. But the bombs, point is, you get what I'm saying.
Big fucking bombs. Yeah. And it's like with quantum computers as well, you know, I make that point as well. It's like you can actually make a computer as powerful as you want using parallel processing, you know, but we keep being sold this idea that there's a quantum computing is on the horizon. And once that comes out, oh, nobody's safe. You know, you're going to get all your passwords are going to get stolen, all your money and everything. The quantum computer will just be able to solve all the encryption, you know. And, you know, I've been following quantum computers since 1996, dude. I mean, it's nearly 30 years. Like, nothing has happened. Like, it's pure smoke and mirrors. And, you know, it's a similar thing with the bomb. So, yeah, I mean, there's, with each of these theories, there is a bogeyman or a scare factor attached to each of them. Of course, from atoms, we get the atom bomb. From gravity, we get things like black holes. And from heliocentrism, we get, you know, space aliens and asteroids, which are new enemies, you know, that people didn't believe in or worry about long ago, but which they do now because they believe in heliocentrism. And then, of course, from evolution, you get viruses, right? It's like they're said to evolve out of the goo. And, you know, the virus is like the sort of bogeyman incarnate. It's like a particle that makes you sick. Again, it's like putting all the power into the smallest scale possible. You know, it's like, oh, it's not, you know, it's not you making you sick. It's not, you know, the government. It's not the, you know, it's this tiny little thing that you can't even see that's like, you know, smaller than, you know, a billionth of the width of a human hair or something like this. You know, it just puts all the power so far away and so low level that you've got sort of almost no choice but to trust the experts, do you? I mean, because you can't see the vibe.
And you could say from evolution you also get, quote, bad genetics and all these, quote, genetic diseases, when it's not genetic diseases, it's literally just that we're being poisoned. And that's what's causing these issues. Like they're saying obesity is a genetic thing. Heart disease is a genetic thing. I don't think that's true at all. that it's just perpetual generations of people being poisoned or buying into or making choices to be poisoned themselves by the choices they make in their own lives.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. So the germ theory actually hides knowledge of healing.
Yeah.
Because you can't, like, when you have a virus, that like, you can't heal it, right? It's like, it's healing doesn't even make sense in the virus theory, right? It's like you have to kill the virus. So it's like, so yeah, you know, we talked about this, but yeah, it's like war, you know, it's a war mentality. It's like kill the disease rather than heal the patient.
Right.
And so, you know, it was always about healing. Alchemy is about healing. You know, true medicine is about healing. And the virus theory takes that away and makes it all about war.
Yeah.
I want to touch on
gravity and heliocentrism, though, like a lot. I think I've touched on the germ theory like every other episode in this podcast. So the ones that I want to touch on quite a bit are gravity and heliocentrism. So do you think that was, for you being a theoretical nuclear physicist, something that was hard for you to wrap your head, no pun intended, wrap your head around initially?
Yeah, I mean, it was about 2016. I started looking at the flat Earth stuff, like the Eric Dubay stuff, and you know, Dave Weiss, a lot of those guys. There was a lot of other people around at that time that aren't around anymore. It didn't take that long, actually. You know, my mind had been opened to a lot of things at that point. I was living in Hawaii, and you know, so I just started taking it on and thinking about it, talking about it with people, and you know, just trying things out. And eventually, you know, came to the conclusion that, you know, I don't live on a giant spinning ball flying through outer space, you know. But then it took me, I'd say, probably spent about 2 years after having that realization. I spent about 2 years like trying to check, you know, thinking I must be wrong. There must be a test out there that proves it, or you're checking the news every day, make sure something, you know, some new information didn't come to light that, you know, changed it. So I was sure, but I was also unsure, because it was like such a big thing. It was just like, you know, and then you see how people react to it, how upset people get if you start questioning gravity. And you realize, wow, it's because gravity is really like the glue that we've been told, it the gravity is the glue that holds the entire universe together. So if you don't believe in gravity, then nothing could exist at all. You know, that's kind of the way people see it. So it's really, it's like a linchpin. But you know, gravity is a made up equation. So there's four forces in physics. They always talk about four fundamental forces, or the standard model. And they say there's the force of gravity, the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, and the electromagnetic force. Now, the electromagnetic force we know is real. It works perfectly well. We can build things with it. But the other three are actually made up equations. You know, they're contrived. They're not the result of, you know, measuring and, you know, like making mathematical relationships like with classical physics. They're actually like hypothesized equations, which they then sort of make to fit the observation. They massage it to fit the observation by changing the values of constants and things like this. So
in this, with respect to gravity, let's say, are we talking about -9.8 meters per second squared?
No, I'm talking about the F equals.
That's what I thought. Okay, because
M1, M2 over R squared. Yeah.
Because that you could attribute to classical physics. But again, that's an effect. That's not proof of cause. We're pointing at an effect. And then they just attribute a theoretical cause or come up with this absurd equation that has never been demonstrated in reality.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's a problem, honestly, that gravity is considered as classical physics.
Would you say that's incorrect? Not gravity, but the equation. The equation, -9.8, just literally observing things falling to the ground. That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, like the rate at which things fall, you know, measuring the rate things fall, you know, that's classical physics. But postulating the existence of a force called gravity as the cause of things falling,
right?
That's sophistry, basically. You know, you're getting into like new territories there. You know, you're postulating forces and particles that no one's ever seen. And, you know, the thing with gravity, it's so unbelievably weak. that is just, again, you know, like with the small particles, it's so weak and small as to be, you know, impossible for anyone to sort of measure effectively. Again, I'm not talking about the rate at which something falls, you know, but actually like to measure the actual force of gravity. And there was only one experiment that did it. It was the Cavendish experiment that they always cite from like 1797. And, you know, they always tell you it's like a really, really hard experiment to reproduce, you know, even though it was done 300 years ago. Oh, he still can't do it. It's just so hard. You know, the apparatus is so sensitive. It's like, you know, anything could be actually causing the readings. And so, yeah, it is a bit like that with gravity. There's a new system they have called LIGO, which is supposed to measure gravitational waves. But when you look at just how sensitive this is, it's ridiculous. Anything could be causing the readings, because they will say it was a supernova. Supernova flashed a million light years away and caused, you know, a little blip on a graph on their machine. It's not convincing enough. It's too easy to just pick it apart, you know. Yeah. But I think most people, they just accept it, right? Because there's this idolatry, there's this kind of idol factor in science, you know, where it's just like, oh, the mighty scientists have, you know, achieved a result. There's not enough people actually just, you know, holding it to account and picking it apart. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember Dave Weiss, speaking of electromagnetism, Dave Weiss, when I interviewed him, he showed this quote. I don't remember who it came from, but by their own admissions, the force or the power of electromagnetism is like 10 to the 30th times more powerful than what they claim the force of gravity is. And that's by their own admission. I think that speaks volumes, because it's really, they're pointing to, okay, this is more sufficient in addition to density and buoyancy to explain this phenomenon than this theoretical thing, this force that we call gravity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Density and buoyancy and electromagnetism are enough to like make things move up or down without having to invoke this like super weak, you know, fictitious force that's like, you know, kind of holding everything together. So yeah, like every other force in nature is able to overcome gravity by, you know, masses, orders of magnitude. So yeah, it's just, but it's like, it has to be there. Because the architects of gravity, which is Newton, Einstein, and Hawking, you know, I would challenge anyone to come up with any other names they can associate with gravity, right? They can. It's like these, and they're held up as the pinnacle of, you know, intellectual achievement. These are the smartest men who ever lived, biggest achievement, you know, in humanity and stuff. But you realize it's just, you can't even talk about gravity without mentioning their names. Like, you have to invoke them because it came from their minds, you know. But you even have like situations where, you know, so you can't, the earth isn't moving, right? Yeah. If you go by the evidence, there's no movement at all. You cannot measure any like spinning or moving through space. And people will say, oh, but Einstein said that. Einstein said there's no way to optically measure the movement of the earth, you know, as if they're saying, well, Einstein's right. But, you know, Einstein believed the earth was moving.
Right. Well, and that's the thing, is there's already that presupposition there. And we just go with the presupposition because it's coming from an authority figure. So even he admitted that there's no way to measure it. I'm sure he was referring back to the Michelson-Morley experiment there, but there's no way to measure it, but then he's still presupposing that it moves. And because he's an authority, we just say, okay, he knows better, so let's go with that. And the scientific consensus says this.
And how can you be sure that it's moving if there's no way to measure that it's moving? The only way is to believe in the theory.
Right.
That's it, you know? And so that's why these theorists are held up, you know, in such high regard. But, you know, as I say, like every theory has a philosophy attached to it as well. And so with gravity, because it's all about the power of matter to attract more matter, you know, of course, matter is like money, right? It's like, you know, it's a very materialistic theory, but it transmuted into relativity. So Einstein, changed the theory of gravity into the theory of relativity. But relativity is, at its core, it's about moral relativism. It's you know, relativity is not just a theory about physics, it's a theory about truth. It's a theory that says that truth is not absolute, that there's no reference frame in the universe that is the true measure of what's going on, that actually everything is relative, including truth, including morality. So, you know, with moral relativism, the idea is that there is no objective right and wrong. There is only, you know, what I say is right for me. What you say is right for you. Now, clearly there is some relativity between, you know, different experiences from people to people, but, you know, it's quite a solid thing in, you know, religion and all that, that, you know, there is like a moral sort of standard in the universe. And, you know, so relativity really attacks that as well, you know. So we have these, each of these theories, they have a corresponding philosophy where it's like, even if you don't understand the theory, just as long as you believe it, you kind of adopt this attitude towards life, you know, based on the theory. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's where people come up with, quote, my truth. Like what they're talking about when they say my truth, they're trying to imply that truth is relative, when the reality is what they're trying to point to but failing to point to is that they're having a subjective experience of objective reality. And that's a completely different thing than saying my truth, which means, oh, reality is all relative. No, reality is reality, and you have your own subjective experience of it.
Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, these ideas are actually really toxic to like a nation or society. And I mean, in my view, like when I look over the history of the 20th century, you know, having that they've been teaching these theories to school children, university people for, you know, generations now. And I see that it's had an absolutely detrimental effect on society as a whole. Now, maybe everyone can't see that, it's just my perspective, but you know, all this stuff that we've been taught that has no application in the real world, you know, the lack of skills of people in the West, you know, when you look to like China and stuff like that, you know, people are very, very skilled, right? It's like they're learning like practical stuff, but we're sitting about getting our heads filled with all this like atomic theory and relativity and, you know, all of it. And we come out of our education with very few skills other than maybe, you know, spreadsheets and computer programming or something like that, you know?
Right. I mean, what you've laid out with atomism, gravity, heliocentrism, evolution, germ theory, that's like the basis for schooling right there. Like that is the school system in essence. And you're filling your head with nonsense that requires that you perpetually appeal to authority figures and just regurgitate what they're saying. And that's what leads you to becoming a mindless, obedient slave to them in order to make income in any way. And that hinders your creative capacity because you're turning to them for truth instead of, you know, seeking within, so to speak, and also seeking these other things and the hidden truths that they're hiding from you, so that you can get out of all that nonsense and actually have a fulfilled life in reality with things that are practical in reality.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh man, I have to tell you, just at the weekend, I was reminded of a game they used to make us play at school. And I asked around a few people, they all remembered it. And I think they still do it today. And but I don't know how widespread it is, but the game was called Heads Down, Thumbs Up.
I remember the game.
Did they do it to you?
Yeah, we played it too. Yeah, absolutely. Like heads down, thumbs up, and then someone walks by and puts your thumb down.
Puts your thumbs down. Yeah. So I was just thinking of that and the symbolism of that, right? It's like heads down, don't look at the truth, and then thumbs up, affirm everything's okay, you know. And then the teacher comes and puts the thumb down. It's almost like, well, it's only not okay until when the teacher puts your thumb down, right? Otherwise, everything's okay. And you know, it just hit me like a, you know, like a sack of tatties, as we say here. It just really hit me that is like the conditioning, like summed up, you know, and people in this country, it's like, you know, everything's fine, but I won't look, at the truth. Everything's great. And, you know, that was what it was like, you know, during the pandemonium and all that. It's, just people pretending everything's fine but refusing to look at the truth. It just all summed up in that game, you know.
I want to touch on Mikkelsen Morley real quick too. Is that cool?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Let's go there. I think that the Mikkelsen Morley experiments are, how do I put this? I think that those experiments had a more detrimental impact. I mean, it depends on how you look at it, right? But like their ideas that came about as a result of these experiments had a more detrimental impact. But when you look at the experiments themselves, they indicate something that is very positive. It's all based on how they interpreted it, where they presuppose that the earth is moving, et cetera, et cetera. So I'd like to touch on that because you do briefly in the book.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, well, the idea is to, you know, they have two lights or lasers, one which is like pointing in the direction that the earth is allegedly moving through space, and the other laser is pointed in the direction perpendicular to that. And they reason that the light would move slower in the direction of movement of the planet because it was having to move through the ether, because the planet's moving through the ether. So at that point, they were, you know, they had the ether theory still in mind, but they also presuppose the earth is moving. So they were taking both of that to the experiment. And then they're like, well, you know, well, the light's definitely going to slow down because of the drag caused by moving through the ether. But they didn't measure that at all. And so you might think, well, okay, then they'd be like, okay, so the earth isn't moving. But right. But actually they went the other way and they said, I thought, well, there's no such thing as ether.
Right. Yeah. So and that's my point. It's all based on the presupposition that they had. What this is indicating is one or the other. And they had already sort of accepted at that point, and virtually all societies and civilizations who are looking into this stuff throughout history had accepted that the fact of ether. And now they cast aside ether, and it must mean that the earth is moving because they already had the presupposition that the earth is moving.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. I mean, you know, I don't know Mikkelsen and Morley personally. I don't know who they were, you know, who was funding them, what were they, you know, what was their agenda. But, you know, that seems to be the story. It was like, you know, they used the result of the experiment to discredit the ether, rather than using it to discredit heliocentrism. Right. You know, they may have been pressured into that. I don't know.
But relativity came out of that, though, right? Essentially, that was like the foundation for relativity, because that's where they started discussing how light and time dilate and bend in such a fashion, right?
Yeah, how you can basically be flying through the universe without feeling anything or noticing anything. It's like relativity allows for that, you know, all the movement to be happening without any measurable effect of it, you know. I mean, relativity is a weird one, you know, and in quantum physics, what they do is they sort of add relativity into the equations and things like that. But if you think your measurements in quantum physics are super small, like when you add relativity into it, it's like, you know, again, a million times smaller. Like it doesn't really affect, you don't need to use it. You know, it's one of those sciences that there really is no use for at all. But they will tout it as if it's the greatest, you know, achievement of any human being in our entire history. But it's actually a very confusing theory and a very problematic worldview that results from it, you know, attack on truth, I would say.
Right. So I already did a whole episode on all the fallacies of the globe with Dave Weiss. So we'll set that aside. But one thing I would like to ask related to the globe, heliocentrism, gravity, is, as a theoretical nuclear physicist, coming from being indoctrinated to believe that, how is it, I don't even know how to frame this. How is it that people truly end up believing those things despite them not being demonstrated in reality?
Well, I mean, when you consider like what you're actually doing, you know, as a theoretical physicist, you know, what you're actually doing day to day, you're just, you know, solving equations, writing computer programs to run codes, produce graphs, yada, yada, you know, that kind of thing. So it's very, all the work was very contained, you know, as I say, it doesn't, it's not really tested. Yeah, it's compartmentalized, and it's just not really tested to the sort of degree that, you know, you can, you'll get plenty of affirmation from like the other people around you, you know, the other people who are working in the same field as you. They'll, you know, they'll talk to you about it. They'll have something to say. They'll have some interest. But it's just, as I say, like a sort of limited hangout. And when you're in it, you don't realize that. It feels like super important. You're part of a club. You're all super smart. You're all doing this work or whatever. But when you come out of academia and you no longer really care about, you know, academic career or anything like that, you look at the world and you see, well, what, you know, 20 years later, has any of this stuff actually led to anything, you know, anything that I can directly say this is a good thing happened as a result of the work that these theorists were doing? And there's nothing I can point to. Like everything I look, just it just like crumbled like ashes, you know. The closer you get to it, it's like the further it gets away.
Yeah,
you know.
I mean, yeah. I mean, that makes sense. It's totally well said. And then for the people who say, as I once did, even as I was waking up to the lie of heliocentrism, why does this matter? And you cover all these things in the book where it's like, okay, they clearly matter. The Hindenburg disaster and airships, the implications for being able to travel that way, which I think that they stopped so that we couldn't discover the truth of both the North and the South, so to speak. And the implications of there being more than what they are telling us, and sort of free energy technologies are sort of wrapped into that. And you cover some of these things in the book, but I hadn't even heard of, I don't know how I hadn't, the Hindenburg disaster and airships I have heard of, but can we touch on why they no longer allow airships to be created and the implications of that relative to heliocentrism?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, I don't know really who was behind it, but what seemed to happen with that disaster, and I actually saw a video, like a colored video of it recently, and it was a very shocking sight, you know, this huge thing like going up in flames. And so this was used to shut down the whole like airship industry worldwide. As far as I know, I don't think there's any countries where they use airships anymore, unless it's just for a gimmick purpose, like the Goodyear blimp or whatever. And yeah, you know, when you think like then that was completely replaced by airplanes, and that's now the dominant method of travel. And, you know, airplanes suck, right? It's like, you know, as a well-traveled person as I am, like it's just gone worse and worse. It's a horrible way to travel now. And of course you can only go to designated areas on the map that have an airport, but with an airship, you can go anywhere, you know, just in any direction, just off you go. You can land anywhere, you can stop anywhere. And, you know, the idea that you would ban an entire mode of transport worldwide because of one accident is also totally absurd. You know, you think about boats, you know, how many boat accidents have there been? You wouldn't just ban all boats.
Right. Without going into any conspiracies relative to the Titanic, like that was a big boat accident that like plenty of people died, and they didn't just ban all boats. How many boat wrecks have there been throughout history?
That's it. By the same logic, they'd be like, that's it. We can't have things floating on the
water. Can't have bicycles anymore, cars,
people
any of them.
Could drown.
Yeah, exactly. It's absurd.
It's absurd. So yeah, I don't know who exactly was behind that, but yeah, the it seems that, you know, airships, they not only prove that Earth is like a plane and you can go anywhere, they also prove that gravity is not a thing. I mean, they're just hanging in the air, you know, like these huge big things just hanging there. It's quite spectacular. The old footage of seeing them like flying over New York and everything, it's like, it almost seems like you're looking in the future.
Yeah.
But you're looking in the past, you know. So
how far back have you found images of these, or sorry, pictures of these airships?
I'm not sure. I mean, I'm just, you know, looking back to, it would have been the 30s. I think it was it 36 when Hindenburg.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a bunch of images and videos from that time of, you know, airships floating over New York and in Europe and stuff like that. But I haven't looked deeper than that, you know, into history. But it seems
I just
like
wonder
a technology
if there, that's like a technology that's pre Wright brothers for flying. I would imagine so.
Yeah, I would imagine so. I don't know for sure, you know, exactly what happened there, but it just seems like that would, you know, to because we can't fly to Antarctica, right? Because there's no airports, you know. And if you go on a boat, you'll get removed by military force. As soon as you get like past the 66th parallel, you'll, you know, a bigger boat will just come along and tell you to leave. But if you had an airship, then you'd just be like, all right, let's go. Just keep going until you like bump into the wall or whatever. You know,
whatever's
there.
Yeah, whatever it is. Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah, and it's with respect to Antarctica. I used to buy into the idea that they're hiding Antarctica from us, and that all countries agree because they have alien technology there, alien technology from outer space. Did you ever think that at any point?
I've heard some stuff like that. Yeah. I've heard.
That's what I used to think, and now I don't think that whatsoever.
Yeah, there's that old map. I forget what it's called now, but it's a huge map. You might have seen it. It's from hundreds of years ago, and it shows like flat Earth, the circle, like Gleason's map style. But on the Antarctica, there's like loads of like, you know, mythical beasts and stuff like drawn onto the map. Oh. You know, sort of suggesting that. Yeah, that this was a land of like mythical beasts and, you know, strange creatures and stuff, which may be the case. I mean, you know, if you think about it, things do seem to get more wild and strange as you get further out from the center. I mean, just look at Australia. You know, the wildlife in Australia is totally out of
this world.
That's
a good point. That's a really good point.
And New Zealand is very strange things going on there as well. So, yeah, you know, you're even further out into Antarctica. I'm sure there may be strange things there, which you could maybe call aliens, but, you know, I doubt they're from outer space.
Yeah. Well, it's also interesting that terrestrial, that means of the Earth. So if you think extra of the Earth, maybe there are other types of beings that are in extra parts of the Earth.
Yeah.
Rather than from other, quote, planets.
Totally open to that possibility. Yeah. That there's other lands or other creations even. But just pure speculation at this point, you know, until we can actually go there and see what's going on. It feels like we're kind of like penned in, you know. It's like on the Truman Show, right? It's like when he starts getting the thoughts that he wants to go, you know, he want to go and travel or whatever. It's like then everything in the world starts conspiring to stop him. You know, he sees like posters of like plane crashes and things like that. It's just like everything all around him,
weird.
Just like trying to put you off going there. It's like that for us as well. Like,
I mean, it quite literally is like with the Hindenburg disaster, airships, like, oh, like people are wanting to travel, go other places, so let's cut off this mode of travel, then make them only use these accepted ones that we have control over.
I mean, it reeks, the whole thing just reeks of conspiracy and control, you know.
Yeah. Okay. So we've already talked atomism, gravity, heliocentrism. I've covered germ theory on plenty of other episodes. Evolution. The last question I have on evolution, then I want to get into alchemy and sort of discuss how all of these sort of dogmatic scientism based approaches are hiding alchemy from the masses, the true science, the true art. So I don't buy into evolution whatsoever, but some people will say that, well, what if evolution did occur? The Big Bang did occur, but it was guided by God. God helped guide that process of evolution. Because, like, I totally understand the traditional the people who buy into evolution overwhelmingly are atheist, maybe agnostic, but most likely atheist, right? And it's a total godless paradigm. But there is this, like, middle ground of people who think that evolution is real. It happened. The Big Bang happened. I laugh even when I say that now, but that it was guided by God. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, what I'd say about evolution is that, you know, someone I know recently said to me that reincarnation is the true evolution. And that might seem a bit strange, but it made a lot of sense to me because there is change that happens from generation to generation. You know, it's like, you know, consciousness is evolving, like spirit is evolving, you know, like things are changing. But when we talk about evolution theory, we mean the transmutation of animals, you know, from goo to you via the zoo. You know, that's what we're talking about. It started with simple life forms and then they somehow wiggled themselves into bigger and bigger and more, you know, clever life forms until getting all the way up to humans. And, you know, that's not supported really by like even like the fossil record or things like that, you know, the missing like in between species and this kind of thing. But, you know, so I would say it's like there still is like an evolution of consciousness which is happening through us, but, you know, it's not an evolution of life from, you know, basic slime up to human beings. I wouldn't say that at all, because it actually hides creation and creativity. And, you know, that's how the big debate that was in the 90s, it was like evolution versus creationism or intelligent design. And so evolution actually challenges the whole idea of creation or the whole idea of creativity or the whole idea of intelligence being a property of the universe itself. Well, it's like, how can I have intelligence? How can I create if the universe isn't intelligent? If the universe can't create, you know, it's like, as an artist, you know, I made all this music. I imagine a scientist in the future found the music and tried to explain it with evolution, you know, that this music just happened to come about through the random interaction of frequencies and all this. You know, it's just absurd. It completely nullifies the intelligence and the creativity that's involved. It was really as I got more into being an artist that I started to get more of an issue with evolution, because I realized it's like a direct assault on the creative process. Like the actual concept of creation is under threat from evolution. You know, that we all just kind of, we're all just bumbling atoms, just like using trial and error to like feel our way through things, rather than this, you know, this intelligent spirit with creative abilities, you know, which, you know, I believe in wholeheartedly. So I think that's the crux of it there, you know, without even getting into the science and the science of it and all that. It's really a philosophy which is opposed to creation. Mm-hmm. And that's my main issue with it.
If you're enjoying this episode, please consider sharing it with at least one friend or family member who you think could benefit from hearing it. You help us grow and reach more people by sharing it with those around you. Also, be sure to head to the show notes to check out our membership offerings, membership marketplace, and more. In nearly all cases with modern health systems, you're waiting months for appointments only to spend a mere 10 minutes with a doctor who quickly hands out a generic diagnosis that is likely rooted in a total misunderstanding of health and causes, and then you're offered a one-size-fits-all medication or invasive treatments with unpleasant side effects. If this sounds all too familiar, consider a different approach with the New Biology Clinic, founded by Dr. Tom Cowan, a respected natural health doctor, author, and speaker. Dr. Cowan's holistic perspective on health and wellness and a deep understanding of the true nature of health and disease sets this clinic apart. With the New Biology Clinic, it's not about quick fixes and suppressing symptoms. The practitioners take time to understand your unique story, recognizing that health is unique to the individual and that illnesses have a variety of causes, physically and metaphysically. Members of the New Biology Clinic enjoy a flat monthly fee that includes a range of valuable services like health consults as needed, practitioner-led live streams on diverse health topics, access to a members-only resource library, and multiple live group sessions every month. These sessions cover fitness, breathing integration, biofield tuning, guided meditation, EFT tapping, and much more. Unlike traditional healthcare systems that thrive on frequent visits, prescriptions, treatments, and suppressing symptoms, the New Biology Clinic's motivation is to make you healthy and keep you that way. Visit newbiologyclinic.com to learn more and use code THEWAYFORWARD for $50 off your account activation. If you're a member of The Way Forward, email hello@thewayforward.com to receive $150 off your account activation. Your journey to genuine healing begins here. Shilajit is one of the world's most popular superfoods. It's loaded with over 40 trace minerals, fulvic and humic acids, antioxidants, and more. It's a resin or tar-like substance that seeps out of the rocks of the Himalayas at extremely high altitudes, formed from centuries worth of decomposing plant matter and microbial activity, distilled by pure rainwater and pressurized by tons of mountainous rock. In a way, you could say it's kind of like the lifeblood of the earth itself, and we can use it to enhance our daily lives by absorbing its power into our body cells. However, if you've tried Shilajit in the past, you know it's true when I say it does not taste good, and that almost seems like an understatement. Some people say it's like licking an old used ashtray, and some people get a little more descriptive than that. Let your imagination run wild. It's pretty bad. But one thing is for certain. I've tried tons of Shilajit products, and no one has ever been able to cover the flavor, let alone make it taste good, until now. My friends at Organifi just released these new Shilajit gummies, and they actually taste good. They deliver 250 milligrams per serving of pure Himalayan Shilajit. Shilajit's benefits include supporting energy production, healthy hormone levels, performance and recovery, promoting collagen synthesis and heart health, increasing cellular energy, and decreasing fatigue. Shilajit has become super trendy in the superfoods and holistic health world for obvious reasons, and people have long been desperate for a solution to the flavor problem. That's why in the few months since Organifi released these, they've already sold out several times. Visit Organifi.com/TWF. That's Organifi.com/TWF, or just head to the show notes. Take a look at their whole collection, and when you go to check out, use promo code TWF. That code is going to give you a 20% discount on all of their products, and they have a lot of amazing products other than their Shilajit gummies. Find out how these superfoods can help you on your health journey today with Organifi. Especially when we realize that we are imbued with the essence of the creator, we also have a co-creative capacity. It's a much more beautiful approach to life. That's a whole thread we could pull on, but I want to get into alchemy instead. I mean, alchemy relates directly to this, by the way, but, So I guess as a general starting point, how have all of those scientism-based paradigms hidden alchemy from the masses?
Well, you know, we talked about how, well, in alchemy, as I say, everything's based on ether, but in science it's based on atoms. But then from the ether, so the ether sort of gives birth to the four elements: fire, earth, air, and water. And really,
you've said in the book that air and ether are one and the same. Would, like, is it kind of a both and that it, everything comes from ether, but the four other elements come from ether, but ether and air are kind of one and the same? Because I've always considered them five, and in the book you say that they're four.
Well, yeah, I realized that, like, all the descriptions I've read about ether, actually it's described to be like an air-like substance, but very, very fine. You know, it's like the finest grade of air, or the highest. The highest
hydrogen,
air,
so the hydrogen is actually ether.
But technically all the elements are ether, you know. You could say, like, water is the wetness of the ether, or earth is the dryness of the ether, you know. It's like the ether has all these different properties that manifest in these four states, like earth, air, fire, and water, which is, like, you know, liquid, solid, gas, and fire or plasma. So when you look to the world, when I look to the world, I see that everything is fire, earth, air, and water, literally everything. You know, if it's dry and solid, it's earth. You know, if it's wet and watery, it's water. You know, if it's dry and airy, it's air, and so on, gas and everything. And then there's fire or light, which is, you know, the only element which is able to penetrate all the others. You know, so fire is able to penetrate and purify the air. Fire purifies water. Fire purifies earth. Fire is vibration, and it's able to go through and penetrate all the other elements. And so once you start seeing the world in that way, it actually, everything comes into focus. And the elements mix in life, you know, just like within us, we have bones and teeth, you know, we have dry earth in us, but we also have blood. We also have tears and sweat and semen. We have water. We breathe the air, and we also have body heat, fire. You know, we have our willpower, our voice, vibration, again, fire. So everything can be explained in terms of the four elements. Now, by saying everything is electrons, protons, and neutrons, you know, like they do in science, they're essentially hiding the fact that everything is made from the four elements, you know, and now you have to try and wrestle with the fact that everything is made from these electrons, protons, and neutrons that you can't see or measure and stuff. So they hide the ether, they hide the elements, and then, you know, a big part of alchemy is the transmutation of metal. You know, a lot of alchemists were metallurgists, you know, they were working, making metals for all kinds of applications. And, you know, making metal involves, you know, it's like making soup, right? It's like you heat up the metal, you turn it to liquid, you blend it, you add more heat, you purify it. And, you know, they were making all kinds of different metals. But through science, then we're taught that you can't do that. Like the metals grow inside the earth and you can't change one metal into another. They just are, because they're all made from one specific type of atom. And so you could only change a metal if you can change the atoms.
Yeah.
And the only way to change the atoms is using particle accelerators that cost billions of pounds to run. So that means that basically nobody can do it. You know, no normal person can do it or whatever. So, but, you know, prior to like the 1850s or so, like everyone knew you could transmute metals. It was like not, you know, it wasn't this like theoretical thing, you know, it was occulted. So there's that. And then there's the whole thing with healing, the elixir of life, the philosopher's stone. And, you know, alchemy was all about healing and medicine, really, you know, as well as making stuff. But, you know, the highest application of alchemy is the healing people. And, you know, the elixir of life was believed to be the ultimate medicine, right? It was like cure all disease and extend life in a natural way. And that's been hidden as well now by germ theory and viruses and all this that make it so that people don't even think about healing anymore. It's all about medications and surgeries and, you know, yeah, killing the disease and all this kind of stuff. So the whole healing aspect of alchemy is hidden as well. And, you know, so I say through the evolution, it also hides the creativity. And, you know, with heliocentrism, it hides just the nature of the realm, which is, you know, geocentric, you know, most people know that it was like geocentric long ago, and then it was changed to heliocentric in the 1500s. So alchemy is a geocentric science as well. So like, you see, so every one of these theories is like directly opposed to what alchemy is saying. But the, you know, the proof is in the pudding, and the fact is you can use alchemy to make anything, but you can't use electrons, protons, and neutrons to make anything. You know, you just,
well, that's what you should lay on the book too, and I'd never thought of this before, that electrons, protons, and neutrons are being used to occult salt, sulfur, and mercury.
Yes. Yeah. So that's the next level of alchemy. It gets a bit more subtle when you get
can
into
I pull up a chart? Because I think that, you have this. This is one of the things from your book. I hope you don't care that I took a screenshot of something in your book, but.
No, please. Yes. The Tetractus.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is like the ABC of alchemy, right? So the number is 1 to 4, basically, from the top down. And each of the numbers 1 to 4, they're like the roots of all knowledge, or the root of all numbers. And because all knowledge is symbolic, and all symbols can be reduced to numbers. And, you know, the numbers 1 to 4 are basically the root of the whole number series. And they each have symbolic qualities attached to them. So the number 1 is associated with oneness, you know, the universe, the all, the God, or what they call the monad, but also the ether. Right, this is the one singular ether of which we're all a part of. And then from the 1, you get the 2, and 2 is about gender. And this is masculine and feminine, and this is represented by the sun and the moon. So on the right there, the circle with the dot in the middle is the sun, and then the moon, obviously, the crescent moon shape. And then from there, it gets into the 3 principles. So those symbols there are, from left to right, it's salt, mercury, and sulfur. Now remember, the first split is into 2 genders. So on the left side, we actually have the female aspect. So earth and water are said to be feminine, and air and fire are said to be masculine. The sun is said to be masculine, the moon feminine. So when you come down from the sun there, you get sulfur, which is like the sun's energy in matter. So sulfur is yellow. It's the color of gold, and it has this like energy inside of it. You know, sulfur is used in explosives and corrosives and, you know, digestion and all this kind of thing. So sulfur is like a masculine energy. And then on the left side, you have salt. Salt, because it's earth, it's dry earth, and earth is feminine. It's on the feminine side. And then right in the middle there is mercury. Now, mercury is said to be gender balanced. It has a balance of opposing qualities, not just masculine and feminine, but you know, all other properties as well. Like it's a liquid, but it's also dry, you know, which is a strange one. You know, they call mercury the water that doesn't wet the hands. So mercury is this kind of paradox that has all these like opposing qualities united within itself. And then those three are called the three principles or the three primes, or the tria prima. And then from there we get the elements. So the two downward pointing triangles, that's earth and water, and they're downward pointing triangle because they move down. Like earth and water always move downward toward the ground, whereas fire and air are upward pointing triangles because they move up. And you know, that's not only the way they move, but it's also like where they are in our natural experience of life, right? It's like the earth and the water is beneath us, and the fire, being the sun and the stars and so on, and the air is above us in the sky. And we also have that the downward triangle represents the womb, and the upward triangle represents the phallus. And this is because the sky with the fire and the air is Father Sky. That's what it's known as, like universally in tribal cultures and so on. It's like Father Sky, Mother Earth. Yeah. So the earth and the water is our mother, the fire and the air is our father. And it's in the blending of those two like halves of the cosmos that creates us. It's like a sort of a love making that happens between the sky and the earth, and it produces life at the earth's surface.
It's also so interesting that the women's menstrual cycles, their moon, it used to be called their moon, because women tend to be more impacted by the moon phases. Not to say that men aren't, but women are biologically impacted by the moon cycle, whereas the sun tends to be more masculine. And it's I don't want to say women are inconsistent, but when it comes to hormonal cycles of men, they're much more circular day by day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely related, and not just obviously to the menstrual cycle, but to all waters, you know, like
the
blood is water. So the moon affects all the waters. And they say like fixed and volatile. So the sun is considered to be fixed fire in the sense that it never actually stops shining. You know, I know if you lived in the UK, you might think the sun stops shining all the time, but of course it's just the clouds getting in the way, right? The sun is always shining and never stops. So it's fixed, and its timing is very strict as well. The timing of the sun is obviously very strict. You can set your watch by it. I mean, that's literally what we set our watch by. But the moon is irrational, and it's not meant to be a judgment of women, but you know, the moon is irrational mathematically. The cycles of the moon can't be expressed as like a whole number of days or hours or minutes or a whole number ratio even. It's actually an irrational number, which means it's always changing in relation to the sun. It's always like making new perspectives with the sun. And of course, it disappears from the sky completely for like 2.5 days a month. And it goes through this whole like pulsing of increasing brightness and disappearing away to nothing. So it's energetically the opposite of the sun, even though they're both exactly the same size, as we know from an eclipse.
Yeah, it's pretty profound. The other one that you brought up you brought up several charts that were just incredible, and I'd seen them before in some of your other presentations, but the one that I hadn't heard before is the caduceus and the two energies, the Ida and Pingala.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, can we talk? Yeah. Do you have that chart available with you right now?
I have it on my arm.
Yeah, I know that. Yeah, you said show that in the book. You have it on your arm.
I don't have a quick one available right now, but
all good.
I think
okay,
people,
it's all good. It's so, like we're talking
AMA,
about
right, the American Medical Association. Yeah, it's the two snakes winding up a staff with wings on top.
You know what's interesting is a lot of people in America, I think they're typically Christian leaning, think that that represents something evil.
Yeah, even though it's on the American Medical Association, so you know it does have an association with healing. It was funny because
I would say that's a loose
that.
Association with healing though, but yeah. But yeah, I get what you're saying. Like historically it has an association with healing.
Yeah. It has been used that way, but also in other ways as well, you know. The Caduceus, I was thinking about getting a necklace, you know, with it on, and I started looking and they're called nurse necklaces.
Oh boy!
I was like, if you look on Amazon, search nurse necklace, you'll just find all these like Caduceus necklaces. I'm like, oh, I can't get a nurse necklace. But yeah, it's like it's obviously nothing to. It's older than that, you know. It's like, but it's been appropriated by a lot of different organizations that used on their flag or on their logo or the coats of arms. But ultimately, it goes back to Hermes, the Greek god Hermes. Story goes back that he was given this staff with two snakes wound round and the wings on top. He was given it by Apollo in exchange for inventing the first musical instrument. So the story in the Greek mythology goes that Hermes made a lyra, which is like a basically like a guitar, but it's a tortoise shell, and he got some hairs from his mother's head and put the hairs on the lyra and made essentially what would have been the first guitar-like instrument. And as a reward for that, Apollo gave him this staff called the Caduceus, which means a herald's staff. And of course, a herald is someone who, like a messenger, someone who says things to come, someone who can be trusted to convey information from the divine to everyone else, a divine messenger. And that's what Hermes was, and that's what Mercury is also. Mercury is Hermes in the Roman tradition. God Mercury is the equivalent of Hermes in the Greek tradition. And they're always depicted with a caduceus. And so the caduceus, as I understand it, it is symbolic of alchemy through this connection with Hermes, but also through healing and awakening. So the staff represents your spinal column. And the snakes spiraling up represent these two channels in the spinal column called the Ida and Pingala, which are said to spiral up up your spinal column. And when you raise energy up, it causes like an awakening, which is represented by the wings. Wings, of course, are an air element. It's like wings are like freedom to move in the air, and the air is the element of the mind. So there's this sense with the wings representing like an awakened mind or a free mind. But also wings associated with angels, which are like the servants of God. So there's that as well. It's like sort of coming to God. And the snakes, they represent, well, our lower energy, you know, our lower animal nature. Usually when you see snakes in alchemy, that's usually what it represents, is like that we have this lower animal nature that's kind of wily and hard to tame, but that our job is to like kind of tame it and like rise it up to the higher consciousness in the head. And
that's where some of the like Kundalini like yogic traditions come in too.
Yeah, that's it. And so I ended up with this tattoo on my arm, which I got years ago. I can show it that well on there, but.
What's interesting is you say in the book you had originally done that based on DNA, like it was a strand of DNA, which we know is like fictitious. Yeah. So, but it ends up looking exactly like a caduceus and that energy rising up.
Yeah, exactly like it. I mean, it's even got 7 points of crossover, which the caduceus has 7 points of crossover in the snake representing the seven chakras. But I've actually got the chakras in here. Of course, the chakras are aligned with the spinal column, you know, so I don't have a staff and I don't have any wings, but I've got the DNA is like fraying out of the top like wings.
It's too perfect.
So I did that in 2008 and it was you know, it meant something totally different then. And it wasn't until almost 10 years later, I started looking into this symbol, the caduceus. And then I was like, hang on, that looks a lot like, that looks a lot like what I've got on my arm there. So yeah, it's a really interesting symbol. And yeah, it's, yeah, definitely, I think, symbolic of alchemy and healing and awakening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's several other things I want to touch on. One being the periodic table of, quote, elements, and how that is occulting the true elements, which we've touched on briefly here. But that I had also never heard articulated in that way. I'd thought about that as I'd come to understand, like, the true alchemical elements. Which are so much more intuitive. We literally see them, play with them in everyday life, whereas the periodic table of elements has this just unintuitive absurdity about it, that, like, how is this relevant in my life, but this is supposed to be the building blocks of reality? Makes absolutely no sense. Whereas this, like, earth, air, water, and fire, and ether, like, that's, we play with that every day.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's it. So there's no elements in the periodic table, like none whatsoever. And, you know, because I look back, I realized that actually the definition of the word element was changed in the 17th century, right, with the scientific revolution. They kind of appropriated the word element and they used it for these chemicals. But in fact, the chemicals are not elements and the elements are not chemicals. The chemicals are produced from transmutation of the elements. And so the simplest example is hydrogen and oxygen, which are listed on the periodic table as elements, but actually are created from water and fire, right? It's like if you run electricity through water, you'll get hydrogen and oxygen produced at the anode and the cathode. So, you know, hydrogen and oxygen are actually discoveries of man and largely a product of human labor. You know, we talk about, oh, there's oxygen, you know, we breathe oxygen. And, you know, I know people are starting to question that as well. You know, there's oxygen and hydrogen doing all this stuff in nature, but actually these are largely a product of human labor and the transmutation of the elements, fire and water. And all of the so-called elements in the periodic table are products of transmutation of the earth. You know, it happens like in the, you know, in mountains and under the ground where there's like loads of pressure and temperature. And, you know, this is what alchemists are trying to recreate in their laboratories, you know, transmuting metal. They're just trying to recreate what's actually happening inside the earth with the temperatures and pressures that are necessary to transmute the earth into whatever it is, if it's a metal or, you know, a gemstone or something. But it's, yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Lost train of thought there.
No, you're good. Because I had another thing that popped up in my mind that, like, when we say we're exposing ourselves to the elements or get out in the elements, we're not meaning get out and experience zirconium. We're talking about getting out and experiencing the elements, the true elements. You know what I mean? Like, no one says, yeah, I was out in the elements and like zirconium was slapping me in the face. It's like, no, that was the air via the wind, or I was very cold because I immersed myself in cold water or in snow, which is just another form of water. No one refers to the periodic table. When we say the elements, we're already naturally referring to the five true elements.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. And yeah, I mean, it kind of gives the game away when you start getting higher up the periodic table. Like, some of the entries are just totally absurd. Like, there's one called Tennesseum, and they say it has a half-life of 50 milliseconds, you know, which is literally the blink of an eye. So, you know, they created it and then it disappeared 50 milliseconds later, and they call it an element, you know, but, you know, it's really just an incident. You know, yeah. If it was anything at all, it's just an incident, a momentary happening in time. That's all. But they've called it an element because they believe they created a new type of atom. And that's what the periodic table is. It's a table of atoms based, you know, it's based on the atomic number. And it's periodic because, well, I mean, numbers are periodic, right? It's like it's a periodic table because it's, you know, going up in... basically one step at a time up the atomic mass, which is really the density of the substance. So it's like a table that orders substances according to their density, in a periodic way. But yeah, all of those substances are actually produced through transmutation of the four, you know, essential elements.
Yeah. The question that I have related to, let's say, external alchemy, for lack of a better term right now, I can't think of a better way to describe it, because there's a whole element of inner alchemy that I kind of want to close on, like the internal process of alchemy. But in terms of the external alchemy, understanding the elements, would you say that you have used this understanding for self-awareness? Like, you have some of the charts in the book that I've seen you share with me before, related to like the earth, air, water, and fire, as it relates to basically how you're constituted in this lifetime. And then you bring in some of the, you know, pieces of the zodiac and how each house is related to the specific, like, you know, I'm a water sign. I'm a Cancer, which I think is a cardinal water sign, as you lay out in the book. So I think that's the general question I'm asking is, have you used this to know more about yourself?
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, I didn't actually get into this in the book, but I did go into it in the end of COVID stuff a bit, like the idea of the elemental constitution. This is where you take an astrological chart of someone, the chart of the stars and planets at the time they were born. And then from that, you can derive the elements that are sort of present in their constitution, as it were. And then this can help you diagnose, because you can sort of see like tendencies that people have because of their elemental constitution. So just as a simple example, I have a lot of fire and air in my constitution, right? But not a lot of water and not a lot of earth. So you could say that you would expect from that someone to be quite heady, like up in the airy realm, like in the mind, you know, and quite fiery, like, you know, quite a lot to say, or, you know, a fiery energy about them. But then lacking in water, you might say, maybe is not so emotional, right? And I've been accused of being an emotional robot before, you know, or maybe not being sensitive to things, you know, whereas someone who had lots of water in their chart might be more sensitive, more emotional, more empathic, or someone who has lots of earth in their chart might be more practical, you know, more hands-on, like really good at like working with things with their hands, maybe more drawn to like vegetables and vegetarianism. I mean, I had a friend who I did a reading for, and he's like a hardcore vegan, you know, he's like super, he's so into it, like, and he does it really well. He spends so much money on food and everything, he's big into it. I looked at his chart and it was almost all earth. I'd never seen so much like earth, you know, but the earth element is associated with the vegetables, you know, and so yeah, whereas fire element is associated with red meat, you know. So I would expect someone who has high fire in their chart to be, you know, more of a carnivore, but someone who has high earth maybe be more of a vegetarian, you know. So it's things like this. And I would actually like to, for my next book, to be about this and really kind of dive into this deeply, because there's so much you can derive from understanding someone's elemental constitution. And I, you know, I don't know if there's any books out there at the moment, but I think it's even more powerful than the regular astrology. It's like, if you actually get into elemental astrology, then you get so much more information about yourself or your clients, or, you know, whoever you're doing readings for. So yeah, very interesting stuff, and definitely want the subject of a future book.
Is that something that you developed, or is that something that you learned through looking into like occult alchemy texts?
I don't think I developed it. As I understand it, that was kind of how it was, like, back in the day. There was the humor system, you know, this idea of like humors, you know. So we're said to have like four liquids in the body. What was it, like black bile? Gosh, I can't remember them all now, but the humor, basically a liquid corresponding to each of the four elements.
Got it.
And they believed that the balance of those liquids in your body was your elemental constitution. But that theory didn't really seem to have, it didn't really take off or really do that well. But I think it's because you can't really measure these liquids, you know, but you can look at somebody's chart and see the elements that are contained in their core, like light body, right? It's like that's how the configuration of the lights in the sky at the moment you took your first breath. It's like it tells you something about your uniqueness, you know, your unique constitution.
Especially with what Eileen's been doing. I don't know if you've looked into that recently, but she's been taking the zodiac, so your chart, and overlaying it over your biofield, of which there are 12 bands of the biofield, and actually finding where the celestial bodies and luminaries are in your chart based on the sound of the tuning fork.
Wow. Yeah. I didn't know that. Yeah. That's great. Yeah. Yeah. There's something in the birth chart for sure. And, you know, a lot of information about it, a lot of self-knowledge from studying my own birth chart as well. And then there's also the issue with sidereal astrology and tropical, which I don't know, you might want to get in here, but yeah, in some ways the sidereal chart is actually more accurate, I find, than the tropical chart, but, maybe that's for another conversation.
Yeah. That's for another conversation. I'm interviewing astrologers coming up. So, the other thing I want to talk about is, the vessels of transformation. Cause I think it's like there's an allegory in that for just the inner processes, but also for it's a practical way of viewing how you create in life. So you have the lab, the forge, and the crucible. So can you touch on that?
Sure. Yeah. So again, you know, in an old school alchemy sense, you know, you'd have like your laboratory or whatever, your castle, you know, which is your laboratory, where your place of work and prayer. You know, laboratory actually means labor, and oratory, which is labor is work, and oratory is like prayer or speech. So it's a place of work and prayer, unlike a lab, which is just a place of work only. So, you know, the alchemist has a laboratory that is not just a place for work, but also has books and stuff for study as well. And then the forge would be the place, you know, essentially where you're able to bring controlled fire, where you're able to control fire. And, you know, a forge is essentially a fireplace. And then the crucible is the container, like the pots and pans that you're using to do the work in, to actually melt the metals or to transform the material. But those are also symbolic, you know, like I think of it like the computer. So I have my lab here, which is the cabin. I have my computer, which is like my forge, because it's actually controlled fire. You know, the computer is pulling in fire from the electricity plugs and, you know, allowing me to manipulate fire in a very precise way. And so I consider the computer as a kind of forge. And not only that, but a computer is the product of the forge. You know, a computer is something that was made from metal and fire. And then I would say then the software we use, like as a musician or whatever kind of work you do, then the software package that is on your computer is then the crucible, because that's where then the detailed transformational work is actually taking place within the forge, within the laboratory. And it's the whole thing sort of reflects back on us as well. It's like our body is the laboratory as well, you know, and like our soul is like the forge, you know, our soul is like the crucible and the spirit is like the forge, you know, it reflects back like into us as well. And so, you know, the idea with alchemy is that when you do your work in an alchemical way, you're also transforming yourself in the process. You know, you're not just transforming the material, you're also transforming yourself if you do it in the right way. And you know, I even think that that's where they got the idea from in quantum mechanics, you know, this idea that like your observation affects the outcome of the measurement. That's often, you know, one of the new quantum ideas. They say, oh, when you look at things, you're changing it. But the alchemists understood this like long ago, like that actually the way you work with things affects like how you change, you know, as a result of the work.
Yeah. Would you say vice versa? Like the way you change also affects your work, so that your work affects you, and it's like this co-creative process, like you affecting your work affecting you, and this sort of like spiral upward, if you will.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's like you are your work in a way, you know. Right. A lot of people say that there's no real separation between the artist and the art, because Yeah, I mean, well, people even say, like, the only thing you truly own is that which you created yourself, right? It's like everything else is sort of like given to you. But so yeah, that makes sense to me. It's yeah.
The other thing I want to talk about is the significance of the number 7 with respect to alchemy, because that was something pretty incredible that you laid out in the book, in the 7 alchemical processes.
Yeah. So the 7, well, you know, when you get the 4 and the 3 together, so the 4 elements and the 3 principles, what we find is that there's a process, like an actual, you know, physical process that derives from each of those. So from fire, we get calcination, which is the application of fire. That could be just heating or roasting or pulverizing or shaking or, you know, radiating, or even like playing sound to something, you know, because the sound is vibration, is a kind of fire. So calcination is about applying fire to something and purifying it, even like drying tea leaves, for example. And then dissolution is a water element process, which is dissolving in water. And, you know, we know, of course, you dissolve things in water and then separate them out. They become purified. They get purified through the dissolution. And then separation is an air process. So separation is, as what it says on the tin, is just about separating things and putting like with like, you know, so things that are muddled together, take them apart, put like with like, organize them, filter them, sift, you know. And that's an air element correspondence. And then you have the earth process, which is conjunction, which is actually like bringing things together. So you've separated all your ingredients, and then the conjunction is when you bring them all together in right balance. And that's associated with earth because you're kind of actually creating a thing, like a physical thing at that point. And then there's 3 more processes which correspond with the salt, sulfur, and mercury. The next one is fermentation, which is a death and rebirth process in the production of alcohol. The fermentation, it breaks down the sugar, and the sugar is converted to alcohol. So basically the sugar, which is an organic living thing, is broken down, killed, and becomes spirit, which is a, you know, spirit. It's a dead thing. You know, the death of life produces spirit, and that's in the fermentation process.
By the way, I wish we said spirit as cool as you guys do in Scotland, because it just sounds way cooler when you guys say it.
I don't know. Like
I've heard you say that over the last 2 years, anytime I'm on a call with you, I'm like, fuck, I wish I had his accent. That is so cool.
I've been recording my audiobook, so I'm making sure to pronounce my T's.
Yeah.
Scottish people, we do these like glottal T's where it's like Scottish.
Yeah.
Instead of Scottish.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty lazy. I do it all the time, but
I love it though. Okay. Sorry. I had to, because
the 6th process of alchemy is distillation, which corresponds with the spirit. And distillation is when you heat a substance gently, and it actually separates the least dense parts of the substance, separate first. Rise up the distiller, where they're then cooled and separated into another vessel, and then that's called the spirit, because it's less dense, it's more volatile than the liquid that remains behind. And of course that's how they get spirit from, say, in the alcoholic process, right? Like in making whiskey or vodka or something like that, the distillation is a crucial component. So it's the purification of the spirit of the plant that they started with. And then the final stage of alchemy is coagulation, which is associated with salt, because coagulation is about something non-physical becoming physical, like coming into body, like crystallization or materialization, like becoming a body. So those are the 7 processes, but the number 7 is, all over the place in alchemy and all like ancient science and in religion and stuff as well, you know, 7 cardinal sins and 7 cardinal virtues and all that. And it all goes back to what they call the septenary, which are the 7 wandering bodies in the night sky. So you've got the sun and the moon, Mars, Venus, Jupiter, Saturn, and Mercury. And those 7 lights are unique among all of the lights in the sky, because they have these wandering paths, where as all the other stars move in circles, like perfect, like fixed circles. That's why they're called the fixed stars. But there's these seven wanderers, and they get called by lots of different names, like the seven rulers. In the Hermetic tradition, they call them the seven rulers. There's lots of different names for them. And they have different names in different cultures as well. Different names in the Norse, different names in Greek, different names in Egyptian, different names in Roman. But they're all talking about the same thing, those seven lights in the sky that seem to direct the changes down here on Earth. Now, not in a way that takes away your free will, though, but just in a, it's like light, you know, it's fire, it's moving things. It causes things to move in certain ways, which, of course, in astrology is the science of, you know, really understand it, you know, looking at those lights and predicting like how events are going to unfold based on what they're doing. So the number seven, then from there, it comes into alchemy in all kinds of ways. And I talk about just one of the fun ones is that there's seven holes in the head, you know, and that was kind of new to me. I didn't learn that until I was like 40 years old. I'm like, Ricky, I knew there was 10 fingers and 10 toes, but I never noticed that I've got seven holes in my head. It's right there, you know, it's like so close. Like, why did I never count the holes in my head before, you know? Talking to people about it, I think most people don't know that, and it's just one of those examples where the number seven is right up close, really fundamental and close to you. Things like the heart, you know, the heart has seven chambers in it, and people say it's actually a seven-sided form. You know, there was some science about that. A guy came out, it's called the chestahedron. He created a platonic solid, as it were, with seven sides, which corresponds to the shape of the heart.
It also is like seven points of reality. There's up, down, left, right, back, front, and then you are the center point in that. That's seven.
And then in, exactly. So this the seven just crops up everywhere. So it was worth creating a whole chapter just devoted to the seven. Because it sort of manifests in so many ways in creation.
The other thing that you talked about that's coming to mind is the different mudras in some like yogic practices, and how I forget exactly it. You'll lay it out way better than I can, but I think it's the middle finger relates to ether. And then I forget which fingers relate to what, but based on how you configure your hands or when you come together to pray, that's ether, likening with ether in your, you explain it better than I could. So you go ahead.
I mean, I'm not very well practiced with mudras, but looking into them, that was what I got to understand, was that like each mudra is sort of connecting elements in different ways, like a circuit.
Yeah.
So the element on each of the fingers of your hand, ether is the middle finger. That's why it's so offensive. That's what I've been told. That's why it's such an offensive thing, right? It's because they don't.
Because it's offensive to the scientific establishment, and that makes sense.
So with the mudras, they'll connect. I mean, in a prayer position, right? You're connecting each finger to its corresponding other. So it's water to water, fire to fire, ether to ether, earth to earth, and so on. But the other ones, and I didn't really show pictures of them in the book. I just wanted to explain the basic principle. But there's hundreds of mudras, and they connect. Like circuits, so connecting fire to air will produce a different effect connecting fire to water, for example. And if you want to understand what that effect might be, then just consider what happens with fire and air is maybe more explosive, whereas fire and water will like cancel each other out a bit, so
or like water and earth is very grounding or something like that.
So I'm no expert on mudras, but really just wanted to, help people understand that that is where that's coming from. It's an elemental sort of connection that you're making there. And in a way, you're reconfiguring your body. So if you think of the body's an antenna, because it's so full of water, and water is like essentially an antenna of infinite bandwidth. It's able to receive frequencies of all vibrations. So when we reconfigure our body electrically, we're essentially reconfiguring the antenna. And I think that allows us to access different states of consciousness,
Yeah.
channel other energies and stuff. But as I say, I'm no expert in the actual practice of mudras.
Yeah, I just thought that was super interesting, though, and it made sense. It's just interesting how when you explore alchemy, it seems to be that it's just pointing you back to very simple things in reality, and how that, I don't like saying fractal because for me that still implies quantum, but it's like a fractalized nature of reality, as above, so below. And so yeah. many different symbols are pointing us back to ourselves. And that brings me to the next piece. I have two more questions, and one is related to inner alchemy. How has exploring alchemy itself, just like the alchemical arts, helped you with your inner processes?
Well, I mean, ultimately just grounding, you know, feeling like everything makes sense. I mean, when I say everything, I'm talking about everything in nature, not necessarily humanity, which is a whole thing to make sense out of. But yeah, you know, nature, which is what I sought out to understand, you know, was to understand fundamental nature of reality. But it was always, you know, so kind of confusing and like this giant mystery until I started to understand alchemy and the elements. And so, you know, there's a satisfaction that comes from that, you know, and just my approach to everything now, like things, doing things yourself are more easy than they used to be, right? It was like, before then it's like, oh, I need an expert, you know, right. I can't possibly do that. I need an expert, or I have to buy this product or that or whatever. But it just becomes more apparent how to just do things yourself. It's actually easier than you expected once you understand just earth, air, and fire and water. And yeah, with it changed the way I make music, and you know, my whole approach to music, which, you know, became more about healing and personal transformation than about just like raging and partying, right? It's like, but you know, when I started out, it was just about the party and like having fun and everything. But then
you use the seven processes when you create music. So I know you talk about audio alchemy towards the end of the book.
Yeah. So I developed, when I first learned about the seven steps, my initial impression was that, well, this is just like how I make music. I was able to, you know, all the different things I do to make music, or that really anybody does to make music, I was able to see how they fit into those seven degrees. And so I developed a whole system for music production called audio alchemy. And I taught that, and yes, that is how I approach it. And but it's maybe not so as methodical as it sounds. Like the benefit of the seven steps is to help people understand all the processes necessary in the creation of a piece of music from nothing, you know, from just raw material to a finished product, which is to say from the lead to the gold. You know, the lead is really any raw material or starting product, and the gold is the goal. The gold is the goal of the work. So, you know, I took that, applied it to music. And, you know, as well as defining the elements of music. So relating, for example, the element of earth relates to rhythm and drums and percussion. And the element of water relates to bass and chords. The element of the element of air relates to melody and lyrics. And the element of fire relates to modulation and timbre and dynamics. I created a system for making music, but I also made all the correspondences between everything in music and everything in alchemy, ensuring that they have a correspondence so that music is a kind of alchemy and everything in music relates to everything in alchemy. And so I tried to lay that out in the book without getting too much into music production, because realizing, you know, most people are not music producers, and actually,
I mean, it's helpful though to see see how you've taken these alchemical processes and applied them to your own work so that others can do the same. Because it really is an incredible, I hesitate to call it framework, because it's not so rigid, but it is, for lack of a better term, an incredible framework to sort of contextualize how you create something out of nothing, or just the creation process itself, but then also the process of becoming internally. And I liken it to the book, The Red Lion. I'm not sure if you've read that book, but that's using external, how do I put this? The journey that the Red Lion takes you on is a journey of inner alchemy, really following the seven processes in the internal to face your shadow and work off karma to create gold out of yourself. And that's an incredible application, in the least, of these seven processes internally to become a more purified, better version of yourself.
Yeah, it's like we are the earth. You know, we are the earth to be purified. You know, that's one of the like dictums of alchemy, you know, is visit the interior lands and rectify to find the hidden stone. It's a kind of cryptic thing, but you know, it's talking about visiting the interior lands of you're the earth. You know, people think it's all about like going underground and, you know, digging holes, going in caves and stuff like that to visit the interior parts of the earth, but it's about going inside yourself, because you are the earth that needs to be rectified. You know, earth is rough, you know, earth is imperfect, earth contains impurities. In fact, of the four elements, earth is the least pure. And fire is the most pure, then air, then water, and then earth. Earth is the dirtiest element, if you like. So, you know, we as earth are born with imperfections and impurities, and it's through our own inner work that we're able to
forged in the fire, which is interesting because the fire is the most pure. So you purify yourself through, that's like people talk about when you do the inner work, you're going into the fire, you're forging yourself in fire to become more pure.
Yeah, that's it. Ordeals of fire, you know, which can, like what we all just, you know, went through these last few years, like of, you know, being like constantly like gaslit. I mean, gaslit, yeah. Right? There is, that's a fire.
Wow.
You know, like being like lied to or accused or like insulted, attacked, all that kind of stuff. That's like an ordeal of fire, you know, and yeah, it's not pleasant at the time, but it's sort of, it gives you metal, right? it creates metal in your being, makes you more resistant to that kind of thing in the future. So yeah, the fire is purifying, but then so is the water, you know, in a different way. But yeah, the earth is fundamentally is rough and impure, and so as beings of earth, we have work to do to, you know, purify ourselves and sort of smooth out the edges and all that, you know.
All right, so if you are interested in getting this book, A Fool's Wisdom, I highly recommend it. When I got halfway through it, I shared it in my Telegram channel. I was like, this book is incredible. At the least, having a theoretical nuclear physicist, or I guess you'd call yourself a former theoretical nuclear physicist at this point, kind of how Tom says he's formerly a doctor, speak out about scientism. And, you know, I've been interacting with and befriending people who speak out about the medical aspect of scientism, but I've not heard someone coming from the other areas of scientism speak out against those other areas of scientism. You're the first that I know of. Hopefully you inspire other people to do the same, because this book is truly incredible. It's an incredible account of authentic expression and pointing us towards the true art and the true science that is alchemy, which I've become sort of obsessed with as of late, especially after reading The Red Lion and looking into Rosicrucianism and reading, I guess you could say, some of Steiner's work touches on it, but just going down this path of alchemy. And it just recontextualizes, as Steve and I have said, some of these sort of mysterious woo, seemingly woo-woo or just absurd theoretical quantum things, and puts it back into reality when you bring back in the five elements, and it just grounds you in reality and it makes sense of things in your life. And it's been incredible for me. So Steve, thank you so much for writing this incredible book. I cannot recommend it enough.
Oh, thank you, Alec. And thanks for having me on. It's been absolutely great chatting to you. You know, I really appreciate everyone who stuck their neck out, you know, before me to bring us the truth on, you know, germ theory and heliocentrism and gravity and all these things. you know, for me, I was like seeing all this going on and I was thinking, well, you know, these, they're telling the truth, you know, the truth is out there. It's like, everyone's going to find out, but, you know, and I didn't really think my qualifications even mattered because I thought, really, these people have done such a good job of putting the truth out there. What does it even matter if I say something? But, you know, then I began to realize, well, it does matter for, you know, for some people, it does matter to someone who actually worked in it and had the qualifications, you know, is saying it again. So even though I'm not saying anything particularly new, or these criticisms of scientism have been around for years, I just tried to bring it all together and share with you that I agree. I agree with these criticisms, for whatever that's worth. But, you know, don't get blackpilled because, you know, yes, the science is bunk, but there is a beautiful ancient science that's there and accessible to all. And you don't need a degree or some expert to, you know, teach you about it. You can just dive right in and start learning about it today, you know. So
aside from your book, is there any other books that you recommend or texts or places to look on alchemy that we could also link in the show notes?
I mean, I could provide you with a reading list. I remember now you asked me that a few months ago. Sorry about that.
All good. That was for my own personal, yeah, like seeking of alchemy, by the way. So,
well, you know, the Hermetic stuff is a great place, yeah, to start, you know, like Pavalion, or, the, you know, the,
correct
Emerald
me if I'm wrong,
tablet.
There's 7 Hermetic principles.
Yes. Yeah.
That's,
yeah,
also interesting. Another point of 7.
Well, the Kabbalion is brilliant. It's very well written. And, you know, that was a big one for me. And the Emerald Tablet, there's a book called the Emerald Tablets of Transformation by Dennis Hauk. Really amazing book, honestly. So, yeah, so well written and very enlightening. Great places to start. But yeah, there's tons of books out there. It's really, there's lots to learn.
I'll hold you to getting me a reading list so I can throw it in the show notes.
Okay. All right, then. Fair enough.
Awesome. Thanks again for joining me, Stephen. Please check out A Fool's Wisdom. That will be in the show notes. Highly recommend reading this book. It's incredible. And thanks again, Steve, for joining me.
Thank you very much, Alec.